This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
First up this hour, we're talking today about Orang Asli, which is a recurring thing that we've been doing on the show recently. We took a look at whether or not the government has done enough for Orang Asli, but today we wanted to, I think, take a slightly different perspective on this, which is how can the government provide support to the community while still respecting ways of life and practices that have been in place for a long time? Because if we're going to look at it honestly, there are many ways in which the government infrastructure, and not a bad thing in and of itself, is just unable to cope with beliefs and ways of life that don't necessarily fit into, you know, neat boxes or ways that can be understood.
In fact, the UN FAO report found that some of the houses that the government in the past had built for the Orang Asli were ones that didn't suit their lifestyle at all, where it was just concrete homes with zinc roofs that did not match how they would build their own homes.
Yeah, so every time we talk about this, there is this, there is a sense, and in some cases, listeners actively bring up, well, how can you help people who are nomadic, for example? Mm-hmm. You know, how can you help people who live in ways that are very different than how we would live in a modern urban setting, so to speak? And I think in those cases, it's not a bad question, because there is something to be said about the fact that if we don't truly understand exactly where people might be coming from or exactly what it is that informs their way of life, it can be hard to provide, especially if you only know how to provide in a certain way.
So before we get too far ahead of ourselves, this is related to an update on the situation in Kampung Kuala Koh. We now know what the mystery illness is that has been affecting the Batik community. It's measles. Health Minister Dato' Seri Dr. Zulkifli Ahmad said up until June 15, the ministry confirmed that 37 people have tested positive for measles based on laboratory tests. He said that the disease spread because of the low coverage of the MMR, that's the measles, mumps and rubella immunization.
So this is, of course, about unequal access to healthcare services, but it's also about things like land rights, access to water, electricity supply, just all sorts of things that get rolled in together whenever we talk about being able to provide for Orang Asli, being able to provide in a way that respects their rights as well.
Yes, that would also be dealing with the current lack of protection on the economic, social and cultural rights of the Orang Asli, while dealing with the fact that the way the government works and the way the Orang Asli live are almost always at direct odds.
Yeah, similar to what you were saying earlier with the housing situation, right? And I do think, like I said, I'm not certain that it's easy to just straight up lay the fault on anybody's doorsteps, because obviously if you are trying to provide services, trying to provide utilities, trying to provide basic things, you know, for the bulk of people in the country, most of whom seem to want to move towards a more settled way of living, literally living in settlements, you know, people who want to live in kampongs, people who want to live in towns, then the way you decide on how to do that is going to be based on the majority. Mm-hmm. And so it is very difficult then to account for situations where you aren't sure where people are going to be and you're not sure what they want. And even if you know what they want, you're like, well, I have to look at what I can provide and see how to go about that. I think there's just a fundamental mismatch here in terms of the way of life and then what the government can provide.
But it also does speak to a larger conversation that we have about how we develop in general, and the nature is seen as the money we pay to develop. So in that case, with the close relationship that most Orang Asli have with nature, nature communities as well, in that sense where one is sacrificed and it doesn't seem to ever have a place where it gels properly, where we always seem to say that this will get in the way of development. This isn't going to match up with my idea of what modernity is. Mm. So we're just going to go ahead and do what's best for the people at large.
And you'll see it's best for you too. And I think that frame of mind is part of the problem. We're crossing over now to Kamal Sulhaimi Fadzil, lecturer in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at UM. Kamal, thanks for joining us. So I feel that many of us, myself included, have an imperfect understanding of the daily lives and practices of Orang Asli in our country. Could you help us kind of paint a picture of that? And what are the main tenets of everyday life that shape practices and belief systems?
I mean, I've worked with different people in different communities. Many of them I've engaged casual friends, some of course as part of research, right? And of course, there's such a diversity of experiences and lives in the Orang Asli community. The Department of Orang Asli Development have categorized them into three groups. You've got the Negrito, the Senoi, and the Proto-Malays. And within these three groups, traditionally, they already have so much diversity in terms of language, the kind of ecological niche they occupy and the kind of things that they do. Some are cultivators, others are fishermen or, you know, riverine communities, and others live in the interior and are nomadic. Today, of course, with the advent of the modern nation state development and all this other stuff, Orang Aslis have, of course, changed like everyone else. But there are also places, communities that do practice their traditional belief system, their religion, that are heavily centered or entrenched within the landscape that they live in. It ties them to their present. For many, it's also a way of making a living, whether the products they gather or consume. But it's also a connection to their past. It's where their ancestors are embedded. The landscape is a place where history is narrated. It's, you know, we have our written traditions, they have their oral traditions. And everyday life today, many of them are impacted by development. And so it doesn't just take away that euphoria, the sense of connection to the environment and the loss of and the sadness or sorrow that comes with it. But there's also a practical loss with the encroachment and the destruction of their natural environment. It also affects their ability to access and to exploit the natural resources for their own, you know, either to consume it or to sell it. So they often lament, if I'm looking for a certain resource, now I have to go further into the forest. Yeah? And they're very aware of people entering and encroaching. And it's very troubling because these people, especially the Jahai in Belum, they see the landscape as, yes, it is their communal right. And people coming in to them are people encroaching without permission. They don't come and ask for permission. They simply walk in, you know. And they're painfully aware that while all this is happening, there are economic opportunities that others are benefiting and not them. So at many levels, every day they wake up, they look at the landscape, tourists come in, people come in, and they feel the loss at many levels.
The health ministry has stated that it's difficult to provide health care to the Batik people as they are a nomadic tribe. How do you provide for the needs of the Orang Asli, whether it's about health care, education, access to clean water and so on, while also respecting their way of life?
Yeah, so not wanting to overgeneralize, a lot of the communities today have been resettled either in resettlement schemes or brought together in clusters to facilitate government delivery of services, whether it's healthcare, education, or sometimes economic development, whether it is all palm estate, you know, that serves the economic needs of the community. I don't know much about the Kuala Koh, but as I understand it, that it is also a resettled population. While they might lead a somewhat mobile lifestyle, I would imagine they do come back to Kuala Koh more regularly than not. So they're not nomadic in the case of, say, some individual communities in Taman, or how they would be in the past, where they would move within their territorial landscape boundary, but they would move ever so often from one point to the other, depending on various factors, including the resource availability at the site. Today, they are resettled. They are in a settlement. The healthcare department is supposed to go in twice, I think, every month. And again, I'm not sure in Kuala Koh, but in other places like where I work in Belong, Temenggong, there are schools in the settlement. So there's a big school in Tiang, Kampung Tiang, which is a village within the Royal Belong, and another to serve the communities around the lower part of the Temenggong Lake. You have one in Banun and another school in Kemah. So in terms of infrastructure and facility, it's there. I think in the case of, you know, if the minister is saying, or if the director general is saying that these people are nomadic, it is very hard. Perhaps we have to revisit that idea that, you know, a kind of one-size-fits-all approach to health services. Maybe some of these services need to be tailored to the communities. And in the past, right, in the 50s, 60s, you had, under the colonial and later early governments, health services that did meet the needs of communities in a far more remote landscape than they are today. So I'm not sure if it is the community's lifestyle that is a problem as much as it is tailoring the services to meet the needs of the community with as minimal an impact on the community's beliefs and way of life. You know, it could be things like lack of budget, lack of manpower. So I'm sure it doesn't lie with the way of life of the orang asli. Rather, it probably has to do with the services needing to keep up the demand of a much more complex environmental condition. So with logging, with mining, with land development, a lot of things are happening, and perhaps the services that the government provide need to cater for these impacts now, rather than to think in terms of a very passive service provider. You probably need to be more engaged and active.
Right. And how does consent, a very important issue, how does consent take shape in these processes?
I mean, so you have the Department of Orang Asli Development, and probably in the past, the idea of consent was through the village headman and the council, Jawatan Kuasa Kampung. Today, of course, in the last few years, the country is signatory to the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. And inside the UNDRIPS, there are recommendations for mechanisms on how we can go about to engage with Orang Asli or Indigenous communities in partnership, you know, and how to draw upon what they call free, prior and informed consent. Of course, that's a concept. We would have to translate that in that one that fits us. But considering that Orang Asli villages do not tend to be extremely big, it's, you know, very possible to have town hall meetings to work at getting consent at a much more nuanced level in the community rather than just from a headman or a committee, you know, which usually underrepresents, say, women or children or youth within the community, usually male representation. Again, I stand corrected, but in the past, I used to see mostly men on this committee. And so, yes, you get consent. First of all, it has to be free, prior, and informed consent that we want. If not, if there seems to be a project managers, the government that approves the project should go to the community, sit down with the community as a whole, and have a series of open conversations to talk there to get consent. But it's not just important that governments, private companies who want to work in Orang Asli landscape go through this prior informed consent process, but they should also have mechanisms for feedback and complaints, you know, and also to deal with any conflict that might arise in the process. A kind of grievance mechanism should be in place. But all this boils down first to recognizing land rights. The Suhakam came up with a fantastic, I think, 18-point recommendation in their 2013 inquiry. Other groups like Sahabat Alam and JAKOSEM, Jaringan Kampung Orang Asli Malaysia, have also come up with recommendations to deal with issues related to land where it encroaches or affects Orang Asli settlements and communities. There are also private sector models that they can look at in dealing with working or developing commercial interests in Indigenous customary areas. So there are these mechanisms. It's just a matter of recognizing it first and then requiring that both the government and private sector engage in seeking out consent so that they can make informed decisions. And it's very important for that grievance mechanism when things do go wrong or if things go wrong in the future, that they can have it redressed.
Have you come across instances where, in providing for the needs of the Orang Asli, the government had failed to take into account the ways of life of the communities? And what impact did that have?
Yeah, when we look at various resettlement or even education programs that have come into the village, I mean, the intentions are quite good. You cannot build a school in every Orang Asli settlement. They're just too diverse, right? And if you want the kind of education approach that we have, a very centralized curriculum within an infrastructure that is replicated throughout the country. So schools are often built in more populated areas and children are required to come to school. I mean, this is just one example. So in the primary level school, because some of the families do live in settlements that are further away from the center, they are expected and encouraged to leave their kids in hostels within the school. So children as young as 7, 8 are expected to go and stay in a hostel, or parents are expected to let their children stay in a hostel, and then the children, you know, get to participate in school. So sometimes that, you know, might not be the best part. How many of us are willing to let go of our primary, you know, age children to go stay in a hostel? I mean, this is just one example. There's so many resettlement programs, bringing people together from different settlements, but not providing an economic livelihood, for example, also affects them in the sense that now they are living in a much larger population, but they don't have the basic infrastructure to meet their needs, like an economic activity, like maybe oil palm estates or proper drainage, simple things. A working toilet, you know, it can lead potentially to other health problems. Also taking away leadership from its traditional format, bringing in leadership based on a value system that comes from outside, having a certain qualification in the formal education system would allow you to become the headman and such. Whereas traditionally, the headmen were often people who were experienced, who had a certain degree of indigenous knowledge of the landscape, of their spiritual beliefs. You know, and these sort of things, once you break down the political structure within this organization, it leads to other sort of, it slowly breaks away at the coherence of the society, you know, and so you find other things creeping in, alcoholism, and this is the kind of things you see, the kind of breakdown in society. Like I think Weber calls it anomie, yeah? The breakdown of the social norms that regulate and holds a society in cohesion. But the intentions were good. They wanted to modernize political structures. They wanted to be able to introduce ideas in the community. Unfortunately, some of it did not have the intended consequence.
So is there a need then to sensitize the government to this at all levels? And what elements would be important in this process of sensitization?
You know, yeah, definitely. We need programs that constantly sensitize government servants and the public in general to understanding minorities in our country, in order for us to understand, appreciate and respect these communities. And, you know, we do. It's just that we sometimes don't see it in a coherent way. We see it in patchworks, you know. I remember going to a talk a few months earlier organized by a government think tank, and they had as their guest of honor a retired police officer from the respected commando unit called VET 69. And so they were celebrating this one man who was a hero in their eyes. His name was He's an Orang Asli Semai who hails from Kera. You know, we have these instances where we do see people who respect him and we hold him up to great esteem. We need to have a wider understanding of Apot within the context of Orang Asli and to respect that. The culture he comes from, and to understand that culture he comes from. I think that's where we lack. It's not that we don't necessarily see the individuals, we just don't see necessarily the whole community in that particular light. And that, we have to challenge our own prejudices and our own, we have our own racism, I suppose.
Kamal, thanks for sharing your perspective on this. That was Kamal Solhaimi Fadzil, lecturer in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at UM. We've been talking today about trying to bridge that gap between respecting culture and respecting ways of life of the Orang Asli community, while also finding ways to provide modern structural support, I think, in many ways. Because I don't know about you, Kelvin, but when I found out that the disease was measles, you know, the disease up in...
Qualico.
Yes, Qualico. It felt... I was just incredibly saddened by that because it's such a preventable illness. And in many cases, it is no longer fatal. And the idea that a marginalized community is left open to a disease that many of us will not encounter anymore, it was terrible.
It leaves me wondering where the administrative gaps were. If, let's say, the rates of vaccination were much lower in that community, what was it that the ministry could have done to increase those rates? Would they have had to study and understand the lifestyles and send researchers and work with universities to understand how they live and where they move and adapt their health ministers, the health officers rather, to fit that, right? And to explain to them what the vaccine is about and then get that treatment to them. So there does seem to be overall, beyond just healthcare, there is a lack of understanding, there is a lack of research that would improve the way we build those infrastructures, the way we come up with policies.
I agree. And we have a message on WhatsApp from Intan Sabrina, which we will get to after the news. We have to head to it. But if you have any thoughts on how we can try to bridge that cultural gap in terms of providing support for Orang Asli communities, call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:36. Good evening. You're with Lynn and Kelvin today, and we're talking about Orang Asli, more specifically because following on from recent cases of deaths in the Batik community and how for a long time it was a mystery illness. Now it turns out the health ministry has said that it is in fact measles, mm-hmm. which again is a completely preventable illness that a lot of us don't even encounter anymore due to vaccinations. I think it's prompted us to kind of revisit this notion of how can we provide for for the Orang Asli community in a way that isn't simultaneously like patronizing or disrespectful of their cultural norms and practices, but also understanding that the way the government works in terms of the bureaucracy, in terms of what it can provide, like how do we bridge that gap? Because it feels very wide.
And in fact, it's not only all that, right? Whether the policies and whatever that they're trying to build for those communities, whether it's suitable in the first place, because we've seen instances where the housing they built isn't right. The water supply that they give doesn't quite work. The electricity that they try to provide isn't quite there also.
It doesn't reach people.
It doesn't reach.
So we're asking you for your thoughts, if you have any ideas on how we might be able to go about this. You know, at this point, I think anything would be welcome. 7733 2900 is the number to call. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. And we have Intan Sabrina here via WhatsApp.
The Orang Asli believe that hospitals and needles and vaccinations are harmful. When one person is ill or admitted into the hospital, they keep away because they believe that bad spirits will possess them. They do not believe in visiting people in hospitals. They do not attend school because they prefer to learn in their own environments. We cannot blame the government completely for the low health coverage of the Orang Asli. We need to engage the Tok Batins, educate them in order to reach a win-win situation. As well as Intan Sabrina says that we have to understand cultural identity and cultural threat amongst Indigenous communities.
Yeah, and that message is also coming from the background of a medical professional. So that is relevant, I think, in this situation. And that point about cultural identity and cultural threat, I think, is hugely important, which was a point made by our guest Kamal earlier as well, that there is a constant trauma that informs the situation that I think we need to keep in mind. You know, it's not easy to have to deal with feeling that loss of cultural identity, feeling the loss of land every day. And it would also be just very flippant of us to ignore that fact.
Yeah, and there's likely a lot that there's a lot of bad faith that the community is working with already, having so many years of just awful, if not traumatic, experiences with government, with private developers, with private agents. So when there is that huge sense of mistrust, it is much harder to implement good policies, even if they're good.
Harban Singh says, on resettlement, can we follow the best practices of, say, Borneo or South America? Jabatan Orang Asli needs to adapt to the new expectations of how we view Orang Asli. They have been a neglected community. It is very sad.
And in fact, there might even be a need to start up a ministry specifically to address the needs of the Orang Asli. We see in New Zealand that one of the prime tenets of their well-being budget is protecting and serving the Indigenous communities there, which also in the same, we share a similar situation where they've the communities have been neglected for a very long time. And also an instance where maybe we just need more orang asli to fill those roles too, so then they have a stronger sense of what the community actually needs.
Which is exactly the point being made by Nick on WhatsApp, saying, I don't know if we have this already, but New Zealanders do. They have native people representing themselves, and I think we should follow that system, that brilliant system. Let orang asli speak for their people. They know better about their community's concerns. And I think that that is important. And there also needs to be a certain level of patience, because one of the key things when it comes to modernization is that everything becomes efficient and therefore faster. Mm-hmm. And so there is also an unspoken assumption that why wouldn't you want things to be easier and faster? And so anytime you meet a community or someone who goes, well, no, I don't actually want what you consider easier. I don't actually want what you think is best. There is this level of impatience that accompanies that, I think. And so maybe if we had more representation, we would be able to have a better understanding of how those conversations can be more constructive.
Yeah, and that brings up, links up to your earlier point, where perhaps some of the ways we try to, well, quote unquote, improve their lives can come off as being very paternalistic and can come off as being very judgy in some ways.
I think so. Nini says, I was at Belum years ago and I witnessed what I would consider to be a bad state, when it comes to the orang asli community. The school was made of plywood and it was made as part of our visit tour. Where is the teacher in this shabbily built school? They were malnourished. If you go to the ground and see for yourself, you know, I wonder who's accountable.
I think we've heard of many incidences. I think one very hot one that happened a while ago was when these kids, they just left the school that they were in, and some of them had unfortunately lost their lives. And that might also speak to the fact that the schools we built and the ways in which we try to integrate them and make them part of society isn't necessarily working out well for the community.
Which goes back to that thing about how clearly, the conversations we've had in the past haven't been sufficiently productive. You know, if you are not providing solutions that work for people, then, and again, I don't think that the fault is laid wholly at the doorstep of the government. I just think that the conversations and this huge gap between what we think of as everybody wants this, that needs to get somewhere, because otherwise we're going to keep having these situations where it's like, There's the school. Go la, study la. You know, and people going, I didn't ask for that.
But to be fair, you could also say that the government, with its massive amounts of resources, they could have afforded and worked towards having those conversations in the first place before implementing any sort of solution or strategy.
I agree. Also, patience. Mm-hmm. If you have any thoughts, you can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.